Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, Harvard Law School Forum, or I should say Harvard looks at Lyndon. And if I borrow from the title of J. Evetts Haley's classic study of our president, I hope only that we are at least as objective as Mr. Haley was in his book, A Texan Looks at Lyndon. It is extremely difficult, of course, to choose a panel for a program such as this, objective experts. We at first thought of someone like Mr. Jack Parr. Those of you who are familiar with the commission report on the character assassination of President Lyndon B. Johnson, the site is 34 Esquire 69, to those law students in the audience. You may recall Mr. Parr's probing analysis of our president as an old folk singer whose feet hurt. Well, fortunately for us, Mr. Parr declined, as well as Ms. Barbara Garson, who, for those of you who don't read the New York Review of Books or Ramparts, wrote MacBird. As the panel was difficult to select, choosing a moderator is equally hard. He must be objective, he must be tactful, he must always strive to ensure a well-balanced presentation. We are fortunate tonight to have the services of Professor Roger Fisher of Harvard Law School, who I understand is now serving as reporter of a special Harvard Law School committee, which is drafting the constitutional amendment, which will prohibit Southern Protestants from holding high public office. Professor Fisher's last visit to the Harvard Law School Forum was as referee for Madam New, and perhaps it's appropriate that he return this evening with Professor Morgenthau and our other panelists. In closing my remarks, and before turning over to Professor Fisher the program, I would like to turn to the words of Arthur Schlesinger in the recent Atlantic Monthly to perhaps set the tone. Arthur Schlesinger, in turn, turned to the words of Santayana, and he said, "It is not true that contemporaries misjudge a man. Competent contemporaries judge him much better than posterity, which is composed of critics no less egotistical and obliged to rely exclusively on documents easily misinterpreted." We are honored to have with us this evening three most competent contemporaries, and let us then forge ahead. Mindful, I would hope, however, are the words of the Egg of Head in MacBird. "It may be true, it all may be true, but he is our king." Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome as moderator I thank Ms. Garson. We welcome then as a moderator for the Johnson presidency, Professor Roger Fisher.
There was a time when moderating this program, all you had to do was deal with Malcolm X or B.K. Nehru or Madam New, Ross Barnett or some character, and you could control the matter and you had something to say. Now the students they pass out printed material telling you all about the people you're introduced. They then take all your best stories and use them up in advance, get the crowd laughing and turn it over for you to do what I don't know. Our topic tonight is the Johnson administration and appraisal. I don't know whether we'll end up with an appraisal. I'm sure we'll start out with three appraisals. Even on matters subject to more objective criteria, an answer depends upon one's point of view. You all know the story of the boy who was asked to take 20% of $1.50 and asked whether he was buying or selling. Our speakers tonight, I'm not sure if the analogy will work very well, because I think some of them will deny that they are buying the administration, and others will deny that they're selling it. They will probably insist that they're not trying to sell it. I hope that each of them will not simply give us his votes in the Johnson popularity contest, but will let us know the standard or standards by which he is making his appraisal. Perhaps it is not too much to hope that by the end of the evening there will be some measure of second order agreement, if not a genuine Johnson style consensus, at least some agreement about what it is about which they disagree. Our first speaker is one of America's most distinguished political scientists. We claim him fairly, although he spent the first 20 years of his life in Germany. Appropriate for the law school forum, he is a lawyer. He's even practiced law for a few years. For more than 20 years, his base has been the University of Chicago, although he's visited here at Harvard on many occasions in the past. He's the author of books too numerous to mention. His major work on politics among nations is now in its third, or is it fourth? Fourth edition. He is a consultant to the Departments of Defense and State. He is also a continuing student. Only last week, he and I were at a meeting together in New York, a meeting where I was doing a good deal of talking and he was doing a great deal of listening, when our chairman asked him why he was so quiet. He said he had come to learn and was still waiting. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to Harvard the Albert A. Mickelson Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and Modern History, Hans Morgenthau.
Mr. Chairman, members of the panel, ladies and gentlemen, we are dealing tonight with a delicate subject. I'm reminded of the story which is told about Sam Goldwyn when he was shown a movie of the first atomic explosion in New Mexico. He was asked what was his reaction, and he said, "It's dynamite." We are dealing tonight with dynamite. So much is obvious. But there is also another aspect to the problem we are dealing with, which makes it delicate and precarious. And I must say right away that I fully disagree with the quotation which the chairman has given of Santayana. For all depends in one's appraisal of a great statesman upon his success or failure. Take everything which you either admire or detest in a statesman. If he succeeds, what is detestable is forgotten, and if he fails, what is admirable amounts to very little. I'm reminded of a statement which Abraham Lincoln once made to the effect that if the end brings me out all right, what is now said against me will mean nothing. If the end does not bring me out all right, 10 angels swearing that I was right will make no difference. So we are dealing here in a very profound sense with an issue which one can only approach with a certain amount of awe, and at least of humility. For what we say tonight may well be negated in one way or the other by the history to follow. Take, for instance, a recent example of a president whose image has vacillated very considerably during the last 20 years. The image of President Truman. When he ascended to the presidency, everybody was horrified, he himself included. But in retrospect, he certainly looks much better than he looked on that day in April 1945, when Franklin D. Roosevelt died. On the other hand, he looked perhaps better 10 years ago than he looks now. At least in my book, he looked better 10 years ago than he looks now, when we know much more about the origins of the Cold War and can see much more clearly the profound miscalculations and misconceptions by which our policy in the immediate post-war period was inspired. However, there is another standard which one can apply, aside from the standard of success or failure. For let me suppose that Lincoln had failed in his policies. Let me suppose that the Union would not have been preserved. I think posterity would still look upon that president as a great man who might have pursued the wrong policies and failed, but whose greatness, his intrinsic greatness, was not affected by his failure. Goethe once said that Raphael would have been a great painter even if he had been born without hands. Perhaps it is this standard one ought to apply. And this is really the only standard I am able to apply in a period of history which does not allow a definitive judgment upon the presidency of Lyndon B. Johnson on the basis of success or failure. But there are certain intrinsic qualities which transcend success and failure, qualities which make for greatness or the opposite. And I think by those standards, we can for a moment judge the presidency of Johnson. It is my view that regardless of what history will say about success and failure, that the conception which President Johnson has brought to his office, and more particularly the conception he has brought to the relation between his office and American democracy, is profoundly mistaken. He's not only mistaken in terms of the history and theory of American democracy, it's also, I think, extremely dangerous to the moral and political health of the Republic. The roots of that misconception lie in the idea of consensus. For the president confounds the consent of the governed with consensus. And those are two different fundamental concepts. An administration has a right to expect a consensus of a large mass of the people only with regard to the very fundamental principles upon which the Commonwealth is based. The rules of the democratic game, for instance, to which all must consent, which wish to participate in that game. But beyond this, a government has no right to expect a general consensus. It can work for and can wish for the consent of the governed. The support for certain policies on the part of the electorate and the withholding of such support is not something to be scoffed at, is not something tantamount to disloyalty, if not treason, but it is a result of the normal dynamics of the democratic process. But the president has consistently, and I say almost instinctively, confounded those two concepts. He does not want only consensus with regard to the basic essentials of American democracy. He wants consensus with regard to his policies in general and in detail. It is for this reason that he has been so sensitive to criticism. And not only has he been sensitive to criticism, but he has had the tendency to equate criticism with dissent from the basic foundations of American democracy. That is to say, he has regarded dissent from his policies not as a legitimate expression of the dynamics of democracy, but as a failure in the duties which a citizen owes his country. It would be tedious for me to repeat to you the quotations which I have quoted elsewhere, and which show clearly to what extent the President tries to push critics, dissenters, at least to the margin of democratic legitimacy, if not beyond it. Only very recently, in his press conference on February 27, answering obliquely the Senate speech by Senator Robert Kennedy, he said, "The issue is very simple. There are those who support the President of the United States and the American people and what they stand for. And there are those who support Ho Chi Minh, North Vietnam, and the communists and what they stand for. We ought to make up our mind which side we are on." Now, I have mentioned this, and I do not find another word, this degeneration of the democratic debate before in a small group of eminent citizens in New York some months ago. And the reply I received was this: there's nothing new in this. Theodore Roosevelt, for instance, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin D. Roosevelt, it's the same thing. Now, I had then the services of an able research assistant, and he went to the polemics in which these three presidents were engaged. And it is simply not true that a president of the United States has ever dared to assume to himself a kind of identity with the fate of the nation and sound policies themselves, and has tried to push his critics beyond the pale into a sphere where only traitors and unreliable people, to at least, dwell. This is something new. And the reflection of this novelty can be seen in the general decay of democratic discourse in this country. I have, of course, a particularly strong feeling about my own experiences, and I have a particular knowledge, naturally, of experience I have had with regard to my criticism of our involvement in Vietnam. And I must say, whenever a spokesman for the administration, private or public, does not impugn my motives, does not try to show that I'm really defending communist China, that I'm soft on communism, but meets the issues head on and discusses them on their merits, I find this a refreshing exception from a rather distressing rule. Some of you will remember the TV confrontation which took place almost 3 years ago now, and in which a gentleman who was then quite prominent at Harvard participated. Nothing was said about the arguments I had advanced then and before about our involvement in Vietnam. But every effort was made to prove that my judgment in matters political had been frequently faulty, and therefore I couldn't be trusted in general. Now, I mention this only in order to show how an example from high on can have an imitating influence upon the people at large. And it is this degeneration of the democratic process for which I must hold the President responsible. And even if he should win the war in Vietnam, and even if he should be able to translate into social and economic facts the legislation which the preceding Congress passed, I think it will still be said that in spite of those eminent successes, there has been a weakening of the democratic fiber in this country because of the example the President has set. I should say in passing and in conclusion that I find it much more likely that this misunderstanding of what democracy is all about is likely to have a deleterious effect upon the substantive policies the present administration pursues as well. Take again the concept of consensus. The concept of consensus is incompatible with the social and economic reforms which generally go by the name of the Great Society. You cannot want both at the same time. For if you want consensus, if you want to have a kind of union sacrée within the country, you must of necessity forego most of those radical social and economic reforms which are incapable of execution without hurting large and powerful vested interests, that is to say, without destroying the consensus. And if you want to put into practice, into social and economic practice, the pieces of legislation the preceding Congress passed, you must forget about consensus, because you are going to be engaged in a first struggle within the country against large and powerful groups which have or think they have a stake in the preservation of the social and economic status quo. So what I have pointed to here is not just a moral matter, even though it is a moral matter as well. It is also a political matter of the greatest importance. And I cannot believe that a president who is incapable of distinguishing between consensus and the consent of the governed can pursue sound domestic and foreign policies within the framework of American democracy. For the pursuit of such policies, first of all, requires an understanding of the basic principles upon which American democracy is based.
They also, I gathered, have a TV program on 5 days a week, too. Almost every Washingtonian of importance has found some occasion to wish that their report, called Inside Report, were not quite so inside. There have been even occasions when some have suggested that the facts are somewhat changed by turning them inside out. As others have studied the Kremlin, he has studied Lyndon Johnson. He and Evans jointly authored the political biography published last year, Lyndon Johnson, The Exercise of Power. It's a pleasure to welcome to Law School Forum, Robert Novak.
Going to be with me on the forum. I suddenly had a sinking sensation that they had asked me to come up to defend Lyndon Johnson, which I might add would have given President Johnson a sinking sensation also. But actually, if President Johnson had bothered to read our book about him, I think he would have found that we do have some good things to say about him. And the book ends with a note of regret, not condemnation, because he could have been, he had all the essentials and all the equipment to be a great president. I think the note of regret is shown by one incident which may seem humorous but is really quite poignant. at the last televised press conference. At one stage, the president started to pull on his ear, and you might have noticed that there was a kind of a giggling by the reporters and moving around. Well, the reason was that they suddenly thought of the joke that everybody was telling everybody in Washington up to that press conference, that how to tell when Lyndon Johnson is telling the truth. When he's pulling on his ear, he's telling the truth. When he's moving his lips, he's not. What was confusing at the press conference was that he was pulling on his ear and moving his lips at the same time. At that same press conference, he was asked whether he was looking for a successor to Henry Cabot Lodge in Saigon, and he said there wasn't a word of truth to that report. And of course, yesterday, when they asked, when Mr. Lodge was replaced by Ambassador Bunker in Saigon, and they asked George Christian, the press secretary, how come the president didn't quite tell the truth last week, and Mr. Christian said, well, he did tell the truth. He wasn't looking for a replacement. He'd already found him. Now, that may be the words, the voice of Mr. Christian, but to us who have covered Lyndon Johnson for some time, it was the words of Lyndon Johnson. And the credibility gap, which is now a credibility chasm, goes far back of the presidential years, and it goes back into the Senate years, when the patterns and the procedures that Lyndon Johnson has used in political life were formed. I think I will go back to those Senate years for a moment, a little ahead, but I think that this is a matter not of partisan gloating by those who are opposed to the president, or of any kind of triumph for his enemies, but one of deep despair, I think, for all Americans, because what the credibility gap means is that the president has lost the confidence, the belief, and the trust of the American people, which is a priceless and a unrecoverable asset that is essential to the work of any president. It is essential because he cannot pursue his program without it. He cannot maintain his policy, foreign or domestic. And from his own standpoint of maintaining his administration in power, I doubt that he can be reelected without it. I think that if the election were held today, that almost any Republican candidate of moderate persuasion would carry from 35 to 40 seats. I am not in the majority of states. I am not in the majority in that opinion, but I do feel, having traveled across the country, that President Johnson's problem with the American people is profound. It has cast a cloud on his presidency and caused him grave troubles. Now, they say that today isn't the election. There's going to be a lot of time between now and the election. And yet, what is going to happen between the now and Election Day to save President Johnson from a fate that occurred only to Herbert Hoover, that is, in this century, that is, the defeat of an incumbent president, nobody can quite explain. Even the end of the Vietnam War, I believe, although it would help President Johnson, would not really bring him back to the point of popularity of 2 years and 3 years ago. Because I don't think Vietnam is really the cause of President Johnson's unpopularity and his problems. It is the catalyst which uncovered all the difficulties that he was bound by his nature and his procedure to encounter as president. Now, there have been other presidents before Lyndon Johnson who have lied, and lied often. Dwight Eisenhower lied about the U-2 affair, and there's no doubt he could have been elected president again and again and again as long as he was alive. John F. Kennedy lied about the Bay of Pigs incident, and the Bay of Pigs disaster, I should say, and to his amazement, and I might say mine also, his popularity polls were much higher after that fiasco than they were before them. But Lyndon Johnson cannot lie about anything. He cannot lie about, he cannot suffer any reverse in his fortunes. He cannot have any setback in the foreign policy of this country without suffering more and more the loss of faith and popularity of the people. I think there are several reasons for that. I think one is that he is the first president in this century to come out of a first Democratic president in this century to come out of a leadership role in the Congress. He is the first congressional leader of the first rank since James Madison actually to enter the White House. And he brings with him to the White House the techniques of secrecy, of deviousness, of keeping the cards well hidden from the rest of the players, from the citizens indeed, that are part and parcel of a legislative leader's bag of tricks, but somehow are not appropriate for a leader in a democratic society in the modern age. And the modern age, the television age, if we might call it that, is, I think, another problem that is not really of President Johnson's own making, but from which he suffers tremendously. In the telegenic age, Lyndon Johnson is at a distinct disadvantage that he would not have suffered had he been a contemporary of Rutherford B. Hayes. Lyndon Johnson, personally, up close, is not always the most attractive man in the world. On television, he is consistently unattractive. It may be that you say this is a country that demands, if a country such as this that demands glamorous, articulate, handsome, dashing young politicians, that this type, there is something basically rotten or basically wrong with a electorate that is demanding this television version of bread and circuses. That may be, but it is the fate of Lyndon Johnson, and he can do nothing about it. There is, however, an extra factor that goes beyond the problems he brings to the presidency as an essentially legislative leader, and also the problem of an unattractive personality in the telegenic age of politics. And that is Lyndon Johnson's own peculiar personality reaction to adversity. He is a man who, by his own personality, could not in the Senate, and more important, cannot in the White House, take it when the going really gets rough. I think disagree profoundly with what Professor Morgenthau refers to as consensus politics, as a degeneration of the democratic process in which President Johnson demands the assent of all or the assent of the vast majority. I have seen Lyndon Johnson, as majority leader, go into a blue funk when two or three senators blocked him or opposed him on some very minor sewer bill or some small appropriation of absolutely no importance. I don't think this was some authoritarian megalomaniac desire for power or for authority. I think that this was the personality trait of whenever he is crossed, he goes deeper and deeper into a hole and sulks. This is a pattern, this is a characteristic that did not really hurt himself as majority leader, but is obviously tremendously damaging to him as President of the United States. Furthermore, since the last year or the last 18 months, President Johnson, in this deep travail and the deep adversity he is in, has been closing in upon himself more and more. The aides, the circle of aides are more and more the politicians from Texas that he trusts most deeply and associates with most easily. The critics who used to be invited to the White House, at least, and tolerated, no longer are. the congressmen and senators who do not always agree with President Johnson no longer are invited to lunch and to dinner. He does not want to hear the dissent across the table. It is, I think, a reaction to a man who has desperately, throughout his political life, wanted not to be obeyed, but oddly, I think, wanted to be loved, and loved by the people and the politicians, and as he's achieved his crest of power, his maximum of power, finds himself one of the most heartily disliked presidents of our time. I think, too, that he is essentially a negotiator, a maneuverer, and he finds his most difficult problem, Vietnam, to be one that is not susceptible to negotiation, not susceptible to maneuvering. It is very difficult to take Ho Chi Minh by the scruff of the neck and put him at the conference table like he would Everett Dirksen. It simply won't work. The tragedy of it all is that Lyndon Johnson is not an Attila the Hun, or he is not a Napoleon, or he is not a Stalin. He is a president whose legislative record, the amount of legislation he put through, both as majority leader and as president of the United States, will stand whether he is reelected or not, and even in whatever the record of his subsequent years in office may be. Furthermore, I think he has, to a surprising degree, bearded the vested interests on matters such as civil rights and the poverty program, certainly more than President Kennedy did, in my opinion. And yet, the fact that with the Vietnam War serving as the catalyst, that he has lost the faith, the confidence, and the trust of the American people, blackens his record as president and casts a cloud upon his presidency.
Last year, one of our panelists wrote and published, "For the most part, the power of Lyndon Johnson has been well used for public purpose." That is not our next speaker. That was our last speaker. Our next speaker can write here on a comparatively clean slate so far as his public expressions of formal commitment to the Johnson administration are since he joined our community here. I first met him, I suppose it's 27 years ago, coming out of the Harvard Union. Since that time, he served in the Air Force, served at Yale Law School, served as clerk to Justice Reed, some teaching, private practice in Washington, Secretary of the Fund for the Republic, all-around consultant to foundations, Democratic National Committee staff on the talent search that put together the first Kennedy team. It was as he was explaining to the Secretary of Defense designate the problems of the Department of Defense and who he might pick. The Secretary picked him, and he ended up as Special Assistant to Secretary of Defense. In that capacity, he dealt with such popular subjects as shelters, fallout shelters. He ran the shelter program during its first incarnation in the Department of Defense. Worked on racial policies in the Department of Defense. Was assigned to the task force developing the poverty program. Supplied food in the Dominican Republic during that operation. An all-around talent, filling a large number of tasks. His most recent government position was as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, and he's finally reached the pinnacle as Professor of Law. Adam Yarmolinsky.
I'm happy to see that as the last speaker on the panel, I'm able to begin from at least a minimal consensus. Lyndon Johnson is neither Attila the Hun nor Rutherford B. Hayes. I tried to address myself to Roger Fisher's question as to the kind of standard by which one should appraise a president and his administration. And I thought of a number of possible standards. One might ask, how does he compare with our latest visitor to Cambridge and to the Institute of Politics, Governor Romney? One might ask, how does he compare to the late Barry Goldwater? Or perhaps to John F. Kennedy? Or, as he himself would certainly want most to be judged, to Franklin Roosevelt. One might ask, will he achieve ultimate success? Or one might ask, what has he done for us lately? One might ask whether he is, unlike King John in the nursery rhyme, a good man. I prefer to ask whether Lyndon Johnson and his administration have been good teachers for the American people in the process of mutual education and frequently miseducation, which I take to be the essence of government in our society. And any appraisal or assessment of this kind of education suggests the desirability, particularly, I suppose, for people accustomed to discussing issues in law school classrooms, of balancing pros and cons, assets and liabilities. I don't want to suggest that in political administrations, as in balance sheets, the assets and the liabilities cancel each other out. I suspect they don't do that at all. An assessment of this kind is a good deal more like painting a picture than it is like adding a column of figures. But I will stick for the moment to the balancing metaphor, at least to the extent of adopting the convention that one may begin in such balancings with accomplishments. And some of these, I think, tend to be too easily forgotten. We can begin with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which, if it has done nothing else, has made it possible for a colored man to walk into any restaurant in the North, or at least in the urban South, with a reasonable expectation of being treated like a human being. And this, it seems to me, is a great education, both for whites and for Negroes. And we should recall also the 1964 tax cut, which was, I believe, the first major use of fiscal instead of monetary policy to affect the course of the economy in a way that economists have been advocating for more than a generation, but for the first time offered economists an opportunity to show what could be done with learning by doing. And lastly, the second session of the 88th Congress saw the passage of the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964, which, by its enactment alone, has dramatized the situation of 35 million Americans who are outside the mainstream of American life. And it has, I believe, also provided a larger and at least somewhat better coordinated effort to deal with that problem than has ever been made before. Now, any achievement doesn't look quite so hard after it's been accomplished. But I can remember the weekly vote-counting sessions in Larry O'Brien's office in the spring and summer of 1964 when it looked as if none of those programs could gather the votes that were needed to put them across. And on a crucial piece of legislation of the kind I've been describing, you get the votes you need to make the difference one at a time. And I remember going through the little booklet that the Whip's office prints up for the House of Representatives with the names of all the members and spaces to indicate yes or no or maybe, trying to find a few more yeses or at least a few more maybes. It wasn't until the 89th Congress that we got Medicare, which has already given hospital care or doctor services to more than 8 million old people, or the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which is providing funds and education for 8 million children, or the Head Start program, which has reached another million children below school age who were going to enter school even then behind their better-prepared contemporaries. And it wasn't until last year that the Demonstration Cities Bill was passed that we achieved our first rent supplement legislation in our history, that the Teacher Corps finally came into existence, that the minimum wage was raised and the coverage of federal wages and hours legislation was further extended. And it wasn't until the day before yesterday that the Senate finally ratified the consular treaty. Into existence, that the minimum wage was raised and the coverage of federal wages and hours legislation was further extended. And it wasn't until the day before yesterday that the Senate finally ratified the consular treaty with the Soviet Union. Now, it's obvious that many of these pieces of legislation are only first steps, and some of them must be even regarded as statements of intention merely. But still, on the positive side of the balance sheet, and this is an educational balance sheet that I'm trying to strike, these declarations of legislative policy are major educational forces. They change national attitudes about poverty, about community action, about the propriety and the importance of federal aid to education, about the uses of fiscal controls by big government, and they've changed attitudes in a way that seems to me not likely to be reversed in the foreseeable future. There's another and less obvious change in government for which I believe the Johnson administration deserves at least a little credit. This is the expanding effort to apply some of the lessons learned, particularly in the operation of the Department of Defense, by way of program planning, functional budgeting, and cost-benefit analyses, to domestic programs, not only at the national level, but at state and local levels as well. The work that's been carried on by people like Harry Rowan in the Federal Budget Bureau and Fred Hayes in the City of New York amounts, I believe, to a quiet revolution in the management of the public sector of our economy, and again, a revolution whose educational lessons are being so deeply embedded that it cannot, in its nature, be reversed. Now, I suppose still on the positive side, I don't claim credit for the Johnson administration for the fact that its first 3 years have come during the longest extended period of continuing prosperity that the United States has known. But I guess it's only fair to observe that if the Johnson administration policies have been designed to break that prosperity, they've been remarkably unsuccessful. More seriously, I think some credit is due for the considered effort to examine the problems of the post-Vietnam economy and the attention that's already been paid to the need for considered government intervention in order to take advantage of the resources that will be available whenever that happy time arrives. And that has been an educational effort conducted against considerable obstacles throughout the government and throughout the private sector as well. Now, mention of Vietnam brings me inevitably to the negative side of the balance sheet. I'm one of those who believes that we made a serious mistake somewhere, or perhaps at several points along the way in the last few years, by becoming so deeply involved in Vietnam. I hasten to point out that these were mistakes I did not recognize at the time, and there were very few people in government who did. On the other hand, I believe that the global consequences of our pulling out of Vietnam at this time would be bad for the peace of the world, as well as for our own ability to deal with other major powers. I believe the President is really convinced that we have to negotiate our way out of this situation, and I believe he is committed to the proposition that the Vietnamese are free to choose any kind of government and make any kind of alliance they wish, and that as soon as there are adequate international arrangements to police whatever agreement we can arrive at with Hanoi, our military forces will be well out of Vietnam. I do not take all the President's statements, particularly some of his more bellicose ones, at face value, and I recognize his difficulty in making himself understood and maintaining communications with a considerable variety of different audiences all over the world. I believe that the task he is preeminently suited for, by background and by experience, is the reconciliation of widely divergent power groups, pulling them away from each other's throats, and persuading them that if they go along, they'll get along. I wish he would get about the task more rapidly. But I have no blueprint for getting the job done. What does trouble me is the effect of Vietnam on everything else, on the relationships between the administration and young people, between the administration and the intellectual community, not only in this country, but throughout the world, on the relationships between the administration and its traditional sources of strength, in labor, in big cities, in the minority groups, in the great uncommitted mass of Americans, and the much greater uncommitted mass of the Third World. Robert Kennedy pointed out recently that more and more of our children are almost unreachable by the familiar premises and arguments of our adult world. In that sentence, for children, one could read citizens, and for adult, one could read government. And then the sentence would read, more and more of our citizens are almost unreachable by the familiar premises and arguments of our government. And he went on to say, the first task of concerned people is not to castigate or deplore. It is to search out the reason for disillusionment and alienation, the rationale of protest and dissent, perhaps, indeed, to learn from it. It seems to me there is increasing disillusion and apathy on the one side and increasing querulousness on the other. Certainly some of this querulousness is a function of the personality of the president. I don't know that I agree with Hans Morgenthau that the president sees his critics any differently from the way most presidents have seen their critics in the past, but they're usually not attacking us when they're attacking their critics. But I do believe that the president has risen above this quirk of character before, and he's certainly capable of rising above it again. What's lacking, it seems to me, on the part of the administration, is an image of itself as a teacher, not only exhorting, but explaining and analyzing, not only justifying, but confessing error, not only pointing out what's been accomplished, but also, and at least equally important, what remains to be done. The President of the United States has the capacity to see himself as more misunderstood than anyone else in the world. What this administration has lacked is the capacity to generate understanding, which I regard as an even more valuable goal than consensus.
Would those who wish to question one of the panelists come forward and make their speech short and ask their question?
This question is for Professor Morgenthau. Sir, do you think that Lyndon Johnson's failure to distinguish between criticism of the authorities and policies of the government and criticism of the regime might become a self-fulfilling prophecy whereby he tells people who are criticizing the authorities or policies that they are criticizing the regime and they grow to believe him and do become critical of the regime? Or do you think that Lyndon Johnson might be right and that there is growing disillusionment not only with the policies and authorities, but with the regime? Do you think that our polity might be converting from one like England's, where criticism of authorities never escalates, to one more like France's?
Well, I think your point is very well taken. I'm indeed convinced, and there's enough evidence to support my conviction, that the very attitude which the president takes toward dissent it tends to bring about the very results which he assumes already to exist. Take so noble and selfless a public servant as Senator Fulbright. It is not a question as to whether one agrees with him on domestic or foreign policy, but certainly here is a man by character and accomplishment entitled to respect. But this man has been treated by the president as if he were an irresponsible fool. The president has mimicked him to his face and has heaped scorn on him in White House gatherings, which simply go far beyond what is permissible. Now, Mr. Fulbright has been pushed by this treatment into a position within the Senate in which she has become a kind of an outsider, a man of whom everybody knows how the president treats him, and therefore who, in a sense, has begun to perform the role which the president has assigned him. And I think it speaks for the strength of character of Senator Fulbright that very rarely he has shown any bitterness with regard to this. But one cannot expect the man in the street, or even an intelligent man of considerable character, continuously to bear this burden of derision, contempt, and even to be read out of the American community without a reacting in kind. So I think the point you are making is extremely important and well taken. In other words, it is a paradox that a president who starts from the assumption of consensus ends up with the reality of alienation.
Mr. Yarmolinsky is commenting on that. Any other questioners can come forward.
I just wanted to add two footnotes. The president has been known to mimic to their faces even persons for whom he has the highest respect. And if one supposes that the connection between the president's attitude toward Senator Fulbright and his power in the Senate is one of cause and effect rather than vice versa, I think one misreads the Senate of the United States.
Yes, want to come forward, please?
This question is addressed to Professor Yarmolinsky. In this picture of the government as a teacher, doesn't this kind of sell short what the people or everybody else has to teach the government? Isn't this one of the basic problems of the administration, that it won't learn from what people have to say to it, that it just closes its ears, that it has all the answers?
Perhaps my notion of the function of a teacher is somewhat different from the one you were relying on. I adopt the law school notion of what a teacher is, which is essentially someone who listens to his students and occasionally comments on what they have to say. I did try to say during my remarks in chief that I saw this process as a mutual one, and I do indeed. I'm talking not about an undergraduate lecture course, but about a law school Socratic exercise or a graduate seminar.
Yes.
Professor Morgenthau, you've made a distinction between the consent of the governed and a consensus. I wonder to what extent that distinction holds in a country partially at war, or at war in fact.
Well, I think it still holds. It is, of course, an argument which has been made in all wars, that criticism ought to stop once war has started. I refer you, however, to a passage which I have quoted from the late Professor Chaffee's book on civil rights, in which he says, I think correctly, that it's exactly in war that free discussion becomes vital. Take, for instance, the situation which existed in this country during the First World War. If there had been no free discussion, our foreign policies might well have been different from what they actually were. If there had not been a certain freedom of discussion in Germany during the First World War, the resolution of the Reichstag asking for a negotiated peace in 1917 would not have been passed. And it is obvious that if that resolution had been acted upon by the imperial government as it was not, everybody concerned, especially Germany, would have been better off. So I cannot accept the notion, and I think it runs counter to the very idea of democracy, even though it is very convenient for whatever government is in power. I cannot accept the notion that because there is war, criticism ought to stop. Quite to the contrary, considering the enormously vital issue with which war is concerned, especially in the present age, criticism ought to be particularly acute and outspoken And I agree with the title of the first chapter in Senator Fulbright's recent book, The Higher Patriotism, which is to criticize the government under conditions most unfavorable to criticism, because it's exactly then that criticism is vital.
Professor Yarmolinsky, I'd appreciate it if you could pursue a little further your comment on Vietnam. When you said that you're convinced that the president wants to negotiate a peace and that you ignore the more bellicose statements the president makes, I mean, it seems to me, as a person, I admit, who does not understand the president or has had intimate relations with him as such as yourself, that there's no reason. Excuse me. There's no reason to ignore the bellicose statements. And if you do, it seems to me that there's more and more every day that you have to ignore. I was just wondering how the president has communicated to you that you ought to ignore that. And using that as an example, I wish you would make a few comments on the more general issue, that is the issue that Mr. Novak raised concerning the credibility gap, using that as sort of an example of it.
Well, let me begin by saying I haven't had a private conversation with the president in 2 years, at least, so that the judgment that I make is has no more credibility or basis in expertise than that of any other regular and faithful reader of the New York Times and of Novak and Evans column as it appears in the Boston Globe. I do, Bob. I subscribe to the Globe. On the problem of the so-called credibility gap generally, I don't find this president, any harder to believe or less hard to believe than the general run of presidents. I am impressed by the consequence of what Bob Novak calls the telegenic, is that the word? Telegenic age? I don't know what that genic is doing in there, but anyway, it must have something to do with TV. The consequences of an age in which anything that public men do gets reported around the world almost immediately. There was a convention under President Roosevelt and I believe under President Truman. I don't remember whether it was abandoned by President Truman or by President Eisenhower, that the president could never be quoted directly, and that when he conducted a press conference, the proceedings of the press conference had to be reported in indirect discourse. I think this was a great convention, and I'm sorry that it was abandoned. If it hadn't, no, it was abandoned under Truman, because it was the famous Truman remark about the use or non-use of nuclear weapons in Korea that sent then Prime Minister Attlee scuttling across the Atlantic in an airplane to find out just what he meant. Well, if you had had the reporting in indirect discourse, you wouldn't have had this hanging on the significance of words that were not intended to have that significance, and you would not have built up to the kind of problems of you said this and no I didn't and you meant it and no I didn't that it seems to me are inevitable in this fantastic degree of exposure that every public man has at the hands of the media. I don't blame the media. I just think it's a problem we haven't figured out how to cope with. Maybe we can have a law school seminar on it.
All right, come down, please.
Well, this is a question for Mr. Novak. Admittedly, I personally feel a certain amount of gap exists between what Mr. Johnson says and what I believe, and I suppose that the comments of Mr. Yarmolinsky are probably fairly true, that every president plays politics to a certain extent. I wondered, however, though, as a member of the Washington Press Corps, do you feel that this credibility gap, if this is something that the reporters play up for a story, or if it's something that's really deeply held by the members of the Corps as professional reporters of the president?
I think that it's a question of degree. Every president lies, but
sometimes it can be done out of all reason. And I think this is precisely what has happened with President Johnson. I think that those of us who watched him intimately in the Senate, who watched him closely there, found that there was often a deviousness for deviousness' sake, as if he was playing some kind of game. It didn't hurt very much in the Senate because he was playing to a small audience, and often it facilitated his progress. It does hurt him very badly as president, not because the professional newsmen can't believe what is told them in the White House, but because the American people have come not to believe it. And this is something that I don't think the White House understands. One very brief example: when the president was coming back from his trip to the Far East just before the election, they had plans for the president to make a political trip through several states in the West, the Midwest, and the Southwest in the last two or three days of the campaign. People who lived in those communities saw the preparations that were going on, the Secret Service men coming in, the ribbons and the bunting being put up, all the undisguisable elements and advance preparations for a presidential visit. When he was, as you know, the visit, these trips were suddenly canceled by the president for reasons that are not entirely clear to me even now. And when he was asked, "Weren't you preparing a trip?" he said in his press conference, "I definitely was not." Well, the fact that further dropped his credibility rating with the reporters, I think, is less important than the fact that those people, and I think there's quite a few of them, who were astute enough to put two and two together to see the preparations right before their face in their hometown and the president's nationally televised statement that there were no preparations, I think this is where the credibility gap hurts, with the people, not with the reporters.
Novak, could I follow on with a question of my own on the problem? I think that the hypothesis that the president's secrecy, which is super secrecy of keeping projects secret until they're announced, is in fact the secret of his power, that on the Hill, he does not announce a project until he takes the high ground. Kennedy used to float a trial balloon, half a dozen senators had come out against it, and then President Kennedy could not before it himself without having to take on people who had committed themselves against it. President Johnson, as I see it, tries to keep something like the merger of the Labor Department and the Commerce Department, or tries to keep this tax refund scheme or some proposal absolutely quiet until he takes the high ground. And now no one can disagree without taking on the president, and this is one of the secrets of his legislative success, results from his this super-sensitive secrecy. Would you agree or disagree?
No, I disagree with that as far as his presidential record goes. His record as Senate Majority Leader, which was a much smaller body of legislation but more difficult to achieve because he had no real majority, was achieved through secrecy. But his presidential record, his great accomplishments, Professor Yarmolinsky listed, were all had a rather long gestation period. Medicare really was around for 20 years. The federal aid to education was around for 20 years. All of the civil rights proposals, without exception, had been around for periods of 5, 10, or 15 years. The Office of Economic Opportunity Bill, the Poverty Act, was a new legislation, but certainly was not kept secret. There was, on the contrary, one of the greatest drum-beating campaigns that I've ever seen that pumped up support all over the country for it. Rather, I think that as President Johnson's fortunes have fallen in the last year or two and his secrecy has become more ingrown, his legislative problems have been more difficult. For example, you mentioned the merger of the Commerce and Labor Department, which has now been junked. One of the reasons I think it had no support is it came as such a shock to the Congress that there was no advanced spade work done. I think that the tax increase bill has had such a difficult time because in his effort to keep it entirely secret, President Johnson did not bother to obtain the support of the key legislators on the tax writing committees. So on the contrary, I think that as president, where his legislative function is entirely different than it was as majority leader, the secrecy has been a handicap rather than an asset.
May I take issue with Mr. Novak as a sometime legislative tactician? I have found that the uses of not floating trial balloons are by and large much greater than the business of preparing the ground openly for a specific proposal. The problem is that the odds of any specific proposal succeeding are very small, because people can always think of 57 reasons why something shouldn't be done, although they may be in favor of the general principle. They are extraordinarily energetic at opposing specific applications of it. And unless you have organized your constituencies, unless you have mobilized the arguments to meet the arguments you know are going to be advanced the minute a specific proposal is unveiled, you're going to be in bad trouble. I think it's kind of too bad that we had to wait as long as we did for a number of the proposals which finally got through, and I suspect that there are a number of proposals which President Johnson has put across simply because he has stage-managed the revelation of the specific proposal, not the general proposition, but the specific proposal at a point where he had the people who were in favor of the proposal prepared to marshal the best arguments in its favor, and where he had had a chance to sound out quietly the people who might be opposed, so they knew what was coming and knew why the administration felt that it was worth pushing for. The tactics of turning any good idea into an actual legislative program are incredibly complex. And if you look at it in advance, you'd suppose that nothing can be done at all. I suppose all I'm saying is that I think that the kind of secrecy that we've been talking about, that Bob's been talking about, can play an important and constructive role, not all the time, but a good deal of the time.
Well, come on down, we'll line up, this will be right. Please.
This question is for Mr. Yarmolinsky. Perhaps I didn't understand your answer to a previous gentleman who asked about negotiations, but I'm very puzzled at what you seem to have gotten out of the New York Times, because I got just the opposite. In fact, I think within the last 2 weeks, James Reston wrote that he didn't see how the government was in good faith moving toward negotiation, and I've read in more than one source that, as a matter of record, every time some move from the other side for negotiation has come to light, usually belatedly to the public in this country, it's been found as a matter of record that the administration escalated the war. So I'd like to ask you directly if you have any evidence, if I may use a lawyer's word, besides intuition or hope or intimation of some sort, that the administration is actively seeking to negotiate this war. And since you referred to Mr. Novak's magazine, perhaps he has evidence of this. I see none in the Times, and I know of none.
I'm afraid I have to say that I read the record differently from the way you do, that I certainly read Scotty Reston's columns differently from the way you do. In the last column I read, which dealt directly with the subject, it seemed to me he was describing in considerable detail, and on the basis, obviously, of information that had been made available to him, the most extraordinary efforts that had been made and had failed simply because Hanoi was not prepared to go that first inch. Now, I don't like to say this kind of thing, and I will say it for what it's worth, and you may decide it's worth nothing. But during the period when I was in the government and privy to what was going on, I know that in each instance where it was charged by some commentators and observers, that at a time when negotiations were making progress, we had escalated. That just was not the case. Now, you have no reason to believe my bare assertion. I can't make it any stronger. Perhaps I shouldn't have made it at all, but I did.
Novak, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, I didn't know it's a small subject, Vietnam, that we might get into for the debate, but I cannot quite understand exactly what the critics of the administration's Vietnam policy expect the administration to do when the Vietnamese, the North, when Hanoi has made by every indication publicly and privately put out the word that unless there is a permanent cessation of bombing, that they will not even consider negotiation. Now that, by any measure, sounds like an ultimatum to me, and not a proposal for negotiations. I think that obviously, if there is any kind of a call for a temporary cessation of bombing, they might be in business for some kind of a negotiation. But since that, in every instance that they have sounded, that my understanding is that they have sounded out informal contacts between Washington and the NLF and Washington and Hanoi, there has been a demand for a permanent cessation of bombing before they will even consider negotiations. I don't think that the subject should fall on the administration. I mean, the criticism should fall on the administration.
Do you want to comment?
Well, I am solely trying to comment. Well, I think the whole problem is wrongly put. I can write a letter to the owner of the Empire State Building and say I am perfectly willing to negotiate with you for the purchase of the Empire State Building. My willingness to negotiate is sincere and obvious, but the offer is also obviously completely impractical because I haven't got the cash to make the down payment. The same is true here. Surely the administration would like to negotiate, provided it can gain at the conference table what it has not been able to gain on the battlefield, that is to say, the destruction of the Viet Cong. And surely Hanoi would like to negotiate, provided it can get recognition of the status, political and military status quo in South Vietnam from the United States. But this is exactly what the war is all about. So there isn't the slightest possibility for negotiations because both sides have put themselves into irreconcilable negotiating positions. It's not a question of sincerity. It's not a question of willingness to negotiate in the abstract. It is simply because the negotiating positions start from incompatible assumptions and are irreconcilable at present. I should also say in passing that when you start from the assumption, as our government does, that this is a foreign aggression and that the enemy is Hanoi, you completely misjudge from the outset the objective situation. Let me suppose, and I'm quoting here almost General Maxwell Taylor's recent book, let me suppose, which is an extraordinary contribution of mine to objectivity, let me suppose that Hanoi is bombed out of existence. Or let me suppose Hanoi signs on the dotted line tomorrow what we have proposed. General Taylor correctly asked the question, and what about the 200,000 Viet Cong in the South who may abide by the agreement signed by Hanoi or who might not? Who is going to force the Viet Cong out of existence if they don't want to go out of existence? So the whole debate about negotiation is, I think, a lot of, if I may use such terms here, hot air, which has no relevance to the actual issues.
I take it that's an appraisal of the Johnson. Chairman Lindsay, do you want to make a brief reappraisal of that point?
Very brief. It is, I'm pained at the inexactitude with which Professor Morgenthau expresses our war aims. As I understand it, no part of our war aims are to compass the destruction of the Viet Cong. If Hanoi will get its troops out of South Vietnam, it's up to the existing government in Saigon to deal with the Viet Cong. I think we've made this quite clear. You're not going to change my mind by either clapping or hissing, and I doubt that you'll change your neighbors. I think that the record is clear on this. One of the points that I tried to make in my remarks in chief, and one of the points that I know the President has stressed, is that it is no part of our objective to achieve a guaranteed non-communist South Vietnam. If South Vietnam chooses, in an internationally supervised election, to go communist, for the first time in the history of
internationally supervised elections. This is something that, I believe it would be, this is something that it is no part of our military objectives to frustrate.
I think some of the audience would prefer the questions were more black and white. Yes.
Lyndon Johnson in 1964 made the mistake of thinking that Barry Goldwater was the Republican Party, and that's all he had really to worry about. And the president and his closest aides were talking constantly through 1964 and into 1965 about the atrophy of political parties and the end of the party system and the rise of consensus politics in that sense, that partisan politics were dying out. As such, he presided over the virtual dissolution of the Democratic National Committee, slashing its headquarters staff, reducing its functions, and paying less attention to party affairs than any Democratic president in memory. I would say that this was totally in character for President Johnson for a couple of reasons. One is that in Texas, where his principal political experience was, there was no party system as such during his principal time as a adversary in elections. He was running in a one-party state in which there were personal political organizations but not party political organizations. Secondly, the Democratic National Committee for President Johnson was, during almost his entire political career, the enemy. It was Paul Butler during the Eisenhower administration who was harassing Majority Leader Johnson, and indeed the bitterest disappointments that Lyndon Johnson suffered in politics occurred at the national forum of the Democratic Party, that is, the Democratic National Conventions. Therefore, it was his feeling that there would be a Johnson Party that transcended the Democratic Party, and there was absolutely no attention paid to party affairs. I think that this was a major, not by any means the major, or the only, certainly not the only cause for the very severe Democratic setbacks in the 1966 election. There has this year been some remedy to these oversights, of these mistakes by President Johnson. There has been, he has authorized the addition of staff, the gradual rebuilding of the Democratic National Committee, a somewhat greater interest in party affairs, but still he has little rapport with the state party leaders. He still has a distrust of the Democratic National Committee as an institution, and one of his many political problems, I believe, is his deficiencies as a party leader.
Thank you, Mr. Morgenthau. It's a plane to catch. We have time for one more question here.
Professor Morgenthau, you've written, I believe, on the relationship between the administration and intellectuals, and I wonder, I'm not clear on whether you believe that an intellectual, and I'd prefer to leave the definition of that creature to you, an intellectual betrays his calling by placing himself in the service of the administration.
Well, I had been misinterpreted as believing that, but I've of course never believed it. Otherwise, I would have been guilty of transgression myself, since I have had connections with the government for decades, and I'm still carried on the roles of the State Department as a consultant, even though the State Department makes very little use of my expertise. There is nothing wrong with an intellectual putting his services as at the disposal of his government, which is in a sense his nation. Quite as the contrary, there is an obligation to do this. And I, for instance, and many of my colleagues have brought considerable sacrifices in lecturing at all kinds of service colleges, not for making money or gaining prestige, but to do what is one's duty as a citizen. This is one thing. However, to create an ambiguity in one's relations between one's profession as a seeker after truth and one's avocation as a helpmate of the government is something quite different. Let me give you, we haven't got time to go into details. Let me give you two examples. A friend of mine, who's an economist, came back from Vietnam, where he had advised on pacification, obviously horrified. He was really shaken. And he said he had seen a man on a stretcher brought into an interrogation center who had been interrogated for 2 weeks and was obviously dying. And he was asked whether he had anything to say, and he said, if I had to do it again, I would, and he expired. And I said, and our people looked on. And I said, looked on? And I said, why don't you write an article about this? And he said, well, I would lose my connections with the government. As the other episode occurred at a state university and was reported to me by a colleague of mine, at which a very prominent man in his field gave a lecture defending our policy in Vietnam. And the next morning at breakfast, he said, this is an unmitigated catastrophe, but I cannot so say so in public because otherwise I would lose my consultantship with the government. This is what I have meant.
On that sour note, on behalf of the Law School Forum, I'd like to thank our three guests tonight, Mr. Yarmolenski, Mr. Novak, and especially Professor Morgenthau. Thank you.